joining us on this first of 3 hours about the imagination. As I hope will become clear, I, but not me alone, feel that the imagination in a way is perhaps even the key human faculty for the recovery of meaning and the sense of the spiritual dimension and the divine in the modern world. I'll particularly say why that might be so in relation to Owen Barfield, actually, in the third session. But the first two are going to look at two other key figures in the modern period since the 17th century for the recovery of the imagination. And by that, the broad point is that the imagination, as Malcolm Guite puts it, as a truth-bearing faculty, that it doesn't just sort of add colour, isn't just about entertainment, but actually is a key capacity we have as human beings, which puts us in touch with reality, and particularly reality beyond the ins and outs of our own minds. Now, there's a lot more to say about it than that, of course, but that is the sort of the beginning and the end of it. And I think these three figures, each in their own way, that we're going to look at, Blake tonight, Carl Jung next week, and then Owen Barfield on the third week, had something to contribute to that, which together makes for quite a rich picture, I hope. That's not just sort of theoretical, not just inspirational, but it's also quite practical, because they all three of them were quite clear in their own way that this is something which, you know, everybody could become more involved with. Yeah, so we've got the hour. I'm going to talk for, you know, a chunk of it, and I could talk for all of it, but I would like to give plenty of just do that. So I wanted to start with William Blake and literally start with some Blake and look at a couple of his images, because I think Blake, really his whole life, one way or another, although there were different phases of his life, one way or another was dedicated to trying to produce both poetry and imagery that could awaken the imagination in us once more, and particularly the imagination, what it can actually do. So let's look at two images and just start to get a sense of that, sort of warm up with a bit of Blake, if you like. So I hope that you can see this image. Wave your hand if you can only see me. You can't see a big image on the screen. That looks like it's working fine.
Yes, it's working fine.
Yep, thanks. So this is Blake's image called The House of Death. And have a good look at it. And I'll just sort of talk through a few points about it. At first glance, to me anyway, it clearly shows the suffering of five poor individuals. There's four lying down to the left and then one tucked in the corner on the right there with his head or her head in her hands. It's called the House of Death because it's thought to have been a plague house in the 17th, the 18th or 19th century when Blake lived. They lie on mats and they're curled up or racked in pain. And at their feet stands another male figure, muscular male figure. His head's bowed, his skin's grey, he holds a knife, if you can see that. And he, it's thought, is the figure of despair. And his dagger that he's got in his hand there is the dart of death. And he kind of taunts the dying with it. He neither directly intimidates them with it, but neither does he just put it down. It looks like it's going to be used at some time. So this is a pretty grim scene that Blake has painted here. Maybe I should just say in parenthesis that Blake's images are always open to interpretation. This is one that I've got from reading around a few commentators and sources. But they say something like that. But then you look again, and you see another presence that actually, you know, when you focus on it, you realize is actually dominating the image. And this is the old man with a long white beard. And he's enthroned on clouds. If you look at the clouds, they're shaped like a throne. And between his outstretched arms, he's unrolled this long scroll. And if you look again at the scroll, you'll see that on each end are these vicious darts that are shooting out. And he looks like a divine figure. He looks like a patriarchal god. But he also looks very preoccupied with his own concerns. Although he's hovering right over the suffering individuals, he doesn't see them. And you might even say that he doesn't care to see them. His eyes are resolutely closed. Now, this is Blake, I think, painting with imagination and with vision. And his paintings have this very distinctive style. They're instantly recognizable because of that. And when he saw people suffering, he didn't just see misery and grief, which other painters in a more realistic or naturalistic mode would see as well. But he did see that, of course. He didn't also just want to make a moral point, I think, about, say, in this case, the links between poverty and pestilence, and between the plague and presumed poverty of these individuals. Although that is there in the picture as well, and he's also well known for his remarks about the poverty of his time. But he sought to show, really, the workings of a whole system that's both spiritual and material. And in this case, what happens when it grimly grips a soul and a society in which that soul lives? So this picture is a worldview, as well as the scene of a plague house, the house of death. It's the image of a world that has come to be ruled by, you know, what you might call a blind pretender god. This is the figure of Urizen that often figures in Blake's images. He painted him in many ways. And his presence creates a worldview that imagines life to be machine-like and material. The darts coming out of Urizen's scroll look quite mechanical. The dagger creates a mechanical air. And you're very conscious of kind of fleshly existence in this image. More broadly, Urizen, in this mode anyway, scorns anything that is not demonstrated by reason or empirical evidence. And I think that's why Urizen doesn't see the human life beneath him. Putting it in a slightly modern idiom, this is the approach to death that really only sees statistics. It doesn't actually see human suffering or human tragedy, let alone any meaning to death. And so I think you can sort of get a sense of that with this Urizen figure who doesn't see the individuals suffering beneath him. And it's an image of what Blake called single vision, by which he mean that things are just seen through this one prism of materiality, without even much sense of vitality, let alone soulfulness. And it's deadly. So that's the first image. And I wanted to contrast it with the next image, which I hope you can see now. Has that popped up a new image? Can someone just wave to say that's happened? Yep, thanks very much. So this is the image of, actually, I'll tell you what I'm just going to do. Do it like this. Is that still all right? Yep. This is the image of the morning stars sang together, as it's called. And it makes a nice contrast because it too features five human individuals at the bottom of the picture there. And they're sitting in what looks like a cave, though they can also see through the ceiling. And they're looking up in wonder. And above them, again, is a cloud. And associated with that cloud is another bearded man. And he's a divine figure again, though, interestingly, he looks quite similar to the man beneath him on the cave-like earth. His arms are outstretched as well, but his eyes are open, and he's looking towards distant horizons. Plus, he doesn't unscroll a scroll, but if you can see, he's sort of unleashing cosmic energy. And that's represented by what's underneath his arms. Because under his right arm is Helios, the sun god, who keeps time, riding a golden chariot across the sky, if you can see that. And under his left arm is Helios's sister, Selene, the moon god. And she rides a silver chariot powered by serpents, which I think stands for all manner of experience in Blake's mythology. And then there's actual space above this divine figure as well. And there's a third section that's in this one. And in it, angels dance with upstretched arms. And they're the morning stars that give the name to the picture, who delight, I think, in that part of reality, the upper quadrants, the upper third of reality in this picture, and has a very different quality. You see the stars there. And it's the quality of what Blake called eternity. And we see four of these angels, but the arms at the edge of the picture suggest that perhaps they continue on to infinity. They go on singing their songs to infinity. So this is from Blake's series, telling the story of Job, and it comes towards the end of the biblical story when God reveals God's awesome creativity to Job in the apocalyptic vision. And the words from that are inscribed. I'll read them out if you can't quite see them. It says, "Canst thou bind the sweet influence of Pleiades or loose the bands of Orion?" is above the picture. And then below it says, "When the morning stars sang together and all the sons of God shouted for joy." So this is Blake painting with imaginative vision again. And again, he doesn't just see individuals, in this case, Job and Job's companions, but also sees the bigger picture. But how bigger this picture is, how bigger this system is, how bigger this society of souls is now. It's not the workings of an oppressive system, but of dynamic creativity. And that signal, because around the margins of the picture, in fact, Blake has charted the scenes of creation in the biblical story, and from "Let there to be light" to "Let the waters bring forth abundantly" in the roundels, if you can see them in the vertical margins of the picture. Now, it's very fascinating that the divine figure is the same as the human figure in look, and that's because the divine figure is the figure that Blake called Jesus, and I put it that way because Blake has quite a particular relationship with this figure, Jesus. He particularly is drawn to Jesus as the incarnation and the state of mind, if you like, that joins humanity and divinity, which is why Job looks like the divine. Jesus is not the savior of a fallen race now so much as the life of imagination and exuberance, which the human side of us can look out of our cave in wonder and see the divine double, if you like, stretching out arms with energy and in touch, not just with the earth beneath, but eternity above. The figures gazing across the cosmos in wonder, gratitude, participating in life. The scene is a kind of kindling of active love, I think, which might amplify the life of all those concerned. The angels above know it already, and the figures beneath are starting to join in with it. The angels do what angels do, you know, they sing in jubilant song. But human life, interestingly, in the figure in the middle there, in Blake's depiction, this figure of the divine Jesus, the imagination, where the finite life meets the infinite life, is the meeting place of heaven and earth. And I think that this is Blake saying human beings are asked to join the finite and material with the eternal and the spiritual in their souls and within society. And that this is what the imagination can achieve. I hope you can perhaps just see the first image alongside it now. I put that up just alongside. Can someone wave just to say that's the case? Yeah, great, thank you. So that, you know, just to have a kind of compare and contrast that. It's the opposite, really, of the house of death. In the house of death, Urizen resorts to a kind of blind force, which W.B. Yeats actually described as the will trying to do the work of the imagination, the will trying to do the work of the imagination. And it's a bleak state. It generates panic and mania, and if not quite death, then a kind of listless repetition and suffering. Whereas humanity in eternity, the second picture I showed there, the main picture now, has access to what Blake called joyful commingling with the whole of creation. And this is very much what he felt the imagination can achieve. It puts you in touch with the fullness of reality. That's why it's truth-bearing. As he puts it in another point, a fool sees not the same tree that a wise man sees. A fool sees not the same tree that a wise man sees. You don't even see the same God as those two pictures show. So I'll stop the image now, and we'll look at some more later. But I hope that gives us a sort of starting point, both to get our imaginations going, give us a taste of Blake, but also an indication of quite how far reaching he thought the imagination can take us. It opens up eternity. It breaks down the barriers of the cave and enables us to share, to participate in cosmic life. So I thought I could just take a step back, really, and ask, why is it that we've got to this point where, in a way, what I'm trying to do is justify imagination? It's not quite an apology for imagination, because I want to say a lot more than just say, give it a go. But how come we've got to this place where imagination needs some kind of defense? But more positively, given that we're in that situation, and you know, when I say we, I mean our society at large, there may well be those of us, you know, you guys who know a lot more about it, maybe even than I do, practically, by that I mean, not just theoretically. But, you know, what might we learn afresh about the imagination, given where we find ourselves? Because, as Barfield put it, descents are always a chance for a new ascent. Nothing is lost. And that's another feature of the imagination, actually. It can always be creative with wherever it finds itself. So one of the starting points for this is that imagination, as we use it now, is actually a relatively recent deployment of the word. In the ancient world, say amongst the ancient Greeks, imagination literally meant receiving the imago. And many sort of understandings of optics in the ancient world conceived of objects giving off an imago, an image that we human beings in our bodies, one way or another, literally take in. So the imagination was just another word for to see, whereas instead of photons or waves, they imagined the imago being given off in various ways. And moreover, our eyes, in Aristotle's view at least, would emit a kind of light that enabled us to see the imago that we were receiving. It's not until the medieval world that the notion of imagination as just an inward activity starts to appear. It still felt to have some contact with the outer world, but gradually becomes something which goes on just inwardly. And you could point to Shakespeare's A Midsummer Night's Dream for a line that captures that. You know, Shakespeare in the Renaissance period, really seminal in understanding in the modern way. And in the Midsummer Night's Dream, he has his famous line where he says, "The lunatic, the lover, and the poet are of imagination all compact." By which he means that the lunatic, the lover, and the poet are similar in that all are using imagination. They're compact in imagination. But clearly the lunatic, the lover, and the poet are doing very, very different things with it. They all, Shakespeare carries on, say, apprehend more than cool reason ever comprehends. So they apprehend, they take in something more than cool ever reason can comprehend. But then you get this question of what they're apprehending, because presumably the lunatic, the lover, and the poet apprehend things in very different ways. They're all things unknown, and they're all airy nothings to quote Shakespeare again. But this problem of discernment is raised. And, you know, Shakespeare is a good person to ask it. Someone who knew very, very intimately the power of the imagination, but also the need to discern and work the imagination in order to make something of it, which clearly he magnificently did. Now, in the birth of modern philosophy, say in the 17th, 18th century, a kind of idea was worked out about how the imagination works and how the discernment of the imagination works. And it puts it actually quite central to the theory of perception, how human beings perceive things. And basically, the imagination is that which gives shape to what would otherwise be a blooming, buzzing confusion, to use William James's expression, a blooming, buzzing confusion. You know, so if you think of looking at your image in a mirror or even on a screen, it takes imagination to recognize that that's not you, that it's some kind of representation of you, and to both know it's yourself, but also know it's not yourself. And that's something that the imagination can do. It helps us to discern reality. It's a very subtle business. I mean, mirrors are quite confusing, but if you think of a rainbow, how the imagination operates when we see a rainbow, it's even more fascinating because we all see the rainbow when we look into the sky and the sun is shining on one end of the sky and it's raining and we look with our backs to the sun and see the rainbow coming through the droplets of the rain. We all see the prismatic effect of light coming through raindrops and so see the rainbow. But at the same time, we all know that the rainbow's not there and that if we went to try and find its end, well, we wouldn't find its end, let alone a crock of gold. And yet we're all sharing the experience of seeing the rainbow. And that's part of the power, I think, of the collective imagination, not just the individual imagination. And if you did a history of rainbows, you would have seen, you could see that how rainbows were interpreted has varied quite substantially over time. And my guess is that that's because the collective imagination has interpreted rainbows in very different ways. So this idea of imagination giving shape to our perceptions is the broadly Kantian approach. And it's the dominant idea now, but it's often confined just to material reality. You know, so it's all very well to say that our imagination depicts the rainbow because we've got photons or light waves coming into our eyes. But anything that's not connected with some kind of physical sensing, the empirical world, falls into question. Is it real? Is it just fantasy? Is it just a product of the mind? Is it just an hallucination? And it took the Romantic movement that emerged about the same time as figures like Immanuel Kant. Particularly, I wanted to think about Coleridge, who knew Blake. They did meet at least once in about 1818. And Coleridge saw some of Blake's work and I think clearly recognized the kindred soul. And what Coleridge said was that the imagination is the creative act. Everything that has been created has been imagined. He thought that the primary imagination of creation is itself the mind of God. He writes this in his Biographia Literaria. So the primary imagination is creation itself, the mind of God. And the secondary imagination, as he puts it, is the imagination which we can share. And it's a sort of human echo of the divine creation. And so it gives life, it gives shape, it gives unity, it gives meaning, it gives connection to us in the continual creative acts that we're engaged with. You don't need to be any fancy artist to be a creative imaginer. You just have to talk, you just have to look, you just have to step outside, you just have to know someone. Your imagination is already fully active in this micro creations that connect with the macro creation and give it its life and vitality, its soulfulness. That's why it's alive. It's not just dead like Urizen might imagine. Now, we clearly also make mistakes. We can be fanciful. We can live in fantasy. We can go mad. What Coleridge said was that you can tell when imagination is true and real because it lasts and it expands us. It is productive. It generates more insights. So a really good example of this, I think, is from Albert Einstein, who famously thought of the theories of relativity by imagining what it was like to travel on a light wave, a light beam. Now, in one reading, that's just a kind of childish activity. But in another way, it led to, well, not just theories of relativity, but the overturning of the whole of physics. And so this was imagination because it was hugely productive, hugely creative of a new way of engaging with the world. And so that is Einstein deploying imagination, not just fantasy. And then, as Einstein put it, knowledge gets sort of drawn down from imagination. You turn it into some maths so you can do something with it, for example. So that's broadly the distinction that Coleridge introduced into the discussion. And I think it's one that really stands up and is a very good one. Now, I might just pause there